Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
You rock star.
Is that really what I am?
No. It was nice to see the Star Ledger, our local paper here in New Jersey. It's the largest circulation daily in New Jersey. And they wrote a really wonderful and complimentary article about it. An excellent food journalist named Brooke Tarbor came to visit with us, and she wanted to find out more about the show. And, well, we're the front page of the food section.
It was nice.
You know, there's a big picture there.
Well, any picture I'm in is a big picture.
Well,
okay?
Big picture,
that's just the way it is.
Well, and in the studio, I'm talking on mic, and you know what? One of the things I realized? There's a reason we're on radio, because I'm losing my hair. No shots from above.
Yeah.
From now on.
Yeah. This is.
Well, you know what's interesting is in the Ledger today, in the food section of the Ledger today, there's the article on us, and they pulled a couple of things that are unbeknownst to us off our website, which I think are really cool. They pulled a couple of recipes. My favorite home foie gras presentation, which you can find on our website, or if you pick up the Ledger today, you can see it there. A goat cheese mousse and a lemongrass roasted snapper fillet and a dry rub for a leg of lamb, all taken from our website. And they printed a bunch of letters that we had gotten. She asked to see our correspondence from listeners, and so they printed a bunch of letters from our people as well. Kudos to the Star Ledger. We thank you for the printing.
Yeah, one of the things that I enjoyed most about the article is that they contacted people, not just from Central Jersey who listen, which is really nice that the people in Central Jersey are listening, but people from around the world who are listening via other medium. You know, radio is a great medium, but the internet has given a whole new audience to this type of show.
And they actually followed up, because we sent the emails with the email addresses, and our listener Walt from West Virginia, they interviewed, and he said very nice things about you. Thank you, Walt. We love you. We'll send you the check. and Kelvin from Chicago also said some nice things. We're happy about that.
Thanks very much.
Also in the Star Ledger today is an article. It's actually from Newhouse News Service. On the Cajachina.
Cajachina is basically a pig roaster that you can do in your own yard, as opposed to, you know, digging a big pit and going crazy and having a 24-hour barbecue. It's a way that you could. It's a machine or a box that allows you to barbecue not in the comfort of your own home. You still have to do it outside, of course, but more reasonably.
Well, it's a Cajachina that it comes from Cuba originally, and you know, Cajachina, there's a common use in Cuba of, like, if you call something Chinese, it's, like, smart. It's tricky. It's cool. Mm-hmm. And they don't know whether it was introduced by Asians or it's just a cool way to barbecue something. But the Cajachina, you can buy one online, and we've used one, and they're great. And
they're great.
It's a wood box. It's lined with aluminum, and then and it has racks in the center, and it fits a pig. It fits exactly one pig, and then you put charcoal on top. Mm-hmm. The thing about roasting a pig is... It takes a long time.
Because part of the reason it takes a long time is because you're only cooking one side of it at a time.
And you put the charcoal on the top, and then you actually have to you need a couple of bags of charcoal, because you have to replenish the charcoal to keep the pig cooking. But in 3 or 4 hours, you can have a roasted pig in your backyard.
A whole roasted pig. Okay, and we're not talking about a 120-pound pig, but a 30 or 40-pound pig fits in this Cajachina and works. I mean, even a 60 or 70-pound pig fits in this Cajachina and works miraculously. I mean, we used to do pig roasts way back in the day when I was in college. We used to do pig roasts and have a lot of fun with them. But it was a 20-hour process,
right?
And the Cajachina allows it to be, you know, almost 15 or 20%.
And there's no digging involved.
There's no digging involved, which is a big deal.
Yeah, so I'm a big fan of the Cajachina. You can check it out. I think, I don't know that we ever mentioned it, but there's got to be a website. Google it.
I'll just share one quick story.
Mm-hmm.
So Francis and I, originally when we started the restaurant, well, maybe not when we started, but a few years later, we bought a Cajachina, maybe 10 years ago, and we had one in the restaurant, and we cooked a pig in it, and it was miraculous, and it was great, and we were happy with it, and we were doing some off-site stuff with it, and it was great, and then somebody dropped a desk on it, and It exploded into a million pieces. That was so it's gone
sad.
Forever.
That was so sad. But, you know, I live in an apartment in Jersey City, and when Jennifer and I are thinking about moving into a house, and we're looking at the borough of Metuchen.
I was like, don't roast the pig on the roof of your apartment in Jersey City. That's not going to work.
But that's on the list of one of the first things I get when I have a yard and a house.
Cajachina?
Is definitely the Cajachina. You know, I want to talk about another thing. It's kind of a gray day out there today. And we are doing a strawberry menu in the restaurant right now. Because it's strawberry season, and strawberries have just come into season about 2 weeks late.
Yeah, really late.
The first strawberries were harvested around this area a week ago last Tuesday, a week ago yesterday. And it's an interesting thing because that's 2 weeks later than it should be. So we had a few events planned around strawberries that we had to push back a little bit. But you know what? When you deal with buying locally and the events and the menus were planned around having the local strawberries, we couldn't say, you know what, just get it the ones from Guatemala in the supermarket. So when you work with nature, when you work locally, you have to be a little bit flexible.
And feeling the pain of the farmer is what Francis and I do, because when you're out there and you have an event planned for a Sunday afternoon in the sunshine and it rains, no good. Or the strawberries aren't in yet. No good. That's all there is to it. You've lost your opportunity.
But it makes it all the better when you get the great strawberries. And by the way, our strawberry season, if it stays hot, is going to be very short in New Jersey.
I would expect with the rain now and the hot weather expected this weekend, I would expect that we're going to have a very short strawberry
season.
But
the strawberries are fabulous.
They are fabulous.
Because we had a very slow build-up to the strawberry season, and we had a really good flowering on strawberry plants around this area this year, you have a lot of fruit on the plants. They've got a lot of built-up energy, and the strawberries we're getting are amazing. We're using them at cocktails stage left. We're doing a strawberry tasting menu.
And the strawberry daiquiri, just a simple classic cocktail. We're making a blenderless strawberry daiquiri. Just at home, you guys, this is something you could make. Take some strawberries.
Actually, I'll give you the exact recipe, just because I wrote out the recipe for the bartenders. It's and by the way, the strawberry tasting menu I mentioned is in Catherine Lombardi.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually using strawberries with balsamic vinegar and spaghetti and tomato sauce together. Believe it or not.
Really interesting.
And what I love about when people order that, they're like, all right, I'll order it.
Actually, I had a chef in the restaurant last night. He's like, I'm not ordering that. I'm here to eat, and I'm not ordering that.
Did you send it to him?
I sent it to him and made him eat it. Sorry.
But you know, people order, look at it like, oh, they're like, all right, if I don't order this. But the look they give you is, and if it's lousy, I'm going to make fun of you. But the people like it a lot.
Yeah.
You got to be creative sometimes. But the strawberry daiquiri, if you want to make this at home, first of all, you need to start with good rum. Bacardi white rum is not going to cut it for a strawberry daiquiri. That's just fuel. Okay, that's what that is. What you need is a Bacardi. Excuse me, a Bacardi. I get all choked up when I talk about rum. A Bacardi Añejo rum, or what works really well is Mount Gay rum.
Mm-hmm.
Works
Mount Gay is a real nice, pretty
very
rum
well.
That's available in the marketplace. And, real nice for this drink.
And if you want some rum agricole, we had a show on with a guy named Ed Hamilton who has La Favorite rums. If you can find his rums, they're more expensive, but they're great.
By the way, just so you know how wacky Francis and I are, we made 10 of these with 10 different rums just to experiment and see which one we like.
You have to have the local strawberries, the really flavorful, red all the way through local strawberries.
They have to be completely ripe.
Right.
Otherwise, they won't smash in the glass when you smash them up.
And the California strawberries, they're not going to give you the flavor you want. You take two strawberries, you muddle them in the bottom of a shaker glass. You just mush them up in the bottom of a shaker glass. You add an ounce and a half of rum, a half an ounce of lime juice, an ounce of simple syrup, which is just sugar water. You shake it up.
Really hard.
And what we do is we add an egg white to give it a little bit of froth. We'll put this recipe up on our website. So it's the strawberries, the rum, the lime, the simple syrup, and the egg white.
And that's it.
Shake it up, and then strain it off into a cocktail glass or what you might call a martini glass, and absolutely delicious.
I will tell you, delightful early summer cocktail.
Blenderless strawberry daiquiri. You know how we talk about farm to table and farm to kitchen? Well, it's farm to bar time. That's what it is in the summertime. All right, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. Our guest today is Dr. Gary Novin. He's a world-renowned conservation scientist. He's also the founder of RAFT, Renewing America's Food Traditions. This past month has seen the release of Renewing America's Food Traditions, Saving and Savoring the Continent's Most Endangered Food, which is a RAFT book and was edited by Dr. Novin. And he is out there championing a lot of the stuff we talk about every day.
Dr. Gary Novin, welcome to the show.
I'm happy to be here with you.
Well, the work you do is amazing, and right in line with what we talk about every day. And our region, let's get right into the meat of the matter, as it were. Talk about saving America's food traditions. What are America's food traditions, and do people even know what their own food traditions are?
Well, every region of this country has a different tradition, and ethnic traditions within each region can be distinctive. But we've lost the memory of all these great foods right at our doorsteps.
You know, that's an issue that I come back to all the time, because we talk about, well, you know we're growing with one of our partner farmers, a guy named Mike Baker, if you're listening, is growing Ramapo tomatoes which were popular in America in the 50s, you know,
and popular in New Jersey in the 50s.
In New Jersey in the 50s and just immediately prior. But we talk all the time about reclaiming our own food traditions, because you know what? My grandmother didn't use Wonder Bread, but I don't have any recollection of how my grandmother got her bread.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. We're actually beginning to eat more like our great-grandparents due to the local and seasonal movement in this country than we have for the last 50, 60 years.
Now, but how do you claim a tradition once it's lost? You know, Mark comes from I'm Irish American, right? Mark's Italian American and French American, and there's been a food tradition handed down from his great-grandmother to his grandmother to his mother and his aunts and to him. But for me, I don't have that same tradition.
Lineage.
But I do feel a right to reclaim, you know, how to put up Jersey tomatoes in August and Jersey blueberries that are about to come out and the Jersey strawberries that are out now. I do feel that I own that tradition, even though maybe I didn't grow up with it.
That's right. There's a wonderful mozzarella cheesemaker in Boston now whose grandfather made mozzarella for Frank Sinatra and his buddies in New Jersey and New York. Her grandfather wouldn't teach her directly, but she went back and learned from the grandfather's co-workers and is now doing it. My grandfather was a Lebanese sheep herder and orchard keeper. I did not learn that from him directly, but boy, do I love dates and boy, do I love lamb. And we raise Navajo Churro sheep, and I wish I would have learned everything that my grandfather could have taught me about sheep herding. But nevertheless, that's part of my tradition, and I fully claim it now, and it's been a wonderful part of my life the last decade.
I don't know. Sometimes I feel like some of that stuff is just programmed in you. You know, some of those traditions that get passed on, you watched and you saw exactly how it was done, and some of it you just intuit.
Well, right. In the case of roasting lamb, that smell of rosemary or thyme on lamb was still with me from when I was a child, and when I smell that now, I'm instantly there. It's genetic memory.
Well, now let's talk about your work in renewing American food traditions. You divided the nation, the political boundaries of the nation state of the United States of America up into several different food nations. Talk to us about that.
They're really food sheds where historically people, for example, in the Pacific Northwest, traded food throughout the Columbia River Basin from the headwaters up in Idaho and Montana and eastern Oregon down through Washington, Oregon, and British Columbia to the coastal area. And that area functioned as a food exchange network for thousands of years, and foods like Ooligan smelt, a grease or oil made from these small fish, were traded up inland for berries and root crops and other foods. And so we're saying we don't need to go back to what people were subsisting on in the 19th century, but we need to save the pieces that are still around and look at more regional exchanges and take regional pride in foods like people in Vermont do with maple syrup or people in the South do with gumbo.
Now, so what are the nations that you've the food sheds that you divided the country up into?
Well, I may not be able to name all of them right off
the bat.
We'll
just name a couple.
We're calling the Gulf Coast gumbo nation because gumbo underlays so many different foods there, whether it's made from sassafras or okra. Chili pepper nation, or the chili pepper food shed in the Southwest. Maple syrup and clam bake nation in the Northeast crab cake food shed from Chesapeake Bay down through the Carolinas.
So we're here broadcasting out of Central Jersey. So we're in Clambake Nation.
You're on the edge of Clambake, crab cake, and maple.
New Jersey's a great place.
Yeah, we're pretty happy about all those things.
When we come,
I occasionally put maple syrup on my clambake.
When we come back, we're going to talk more with Dr. Gary Nobin about America's food shed and America's food history and how we save it, and sometimes how the way to save it is to eat it, sort of counterintuitively. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagut and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or catherinelombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, and we're talking today with Dr. Gary Nobin. His project is Renewing America's Food Traditions. Their most recent book, you can find out more about on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. It's called Saving and Savoring the Continent's Most Endangered Foods. I alluded to something earlier, and it's again a topic that we've talked about in a number of different contexts. But when something is endangered, a food product or a food tradition or a farm animal that we raise for food, sometimes the way to save it is to eat it, right?
For cultivated vegetables, fruits, and livestock, I think that's true. It may not be true for wild fish.
Right, for wild animals, it's not the same paradigm, yeah.
But let's look at some possibilities. A lot of these foods fell off our table because producers couldn't find the people who really wanted to share these and have them as part of their foodways. There's been a disconnect the last 50, 60 years because so many things have been shipped across the country and the producers don't even know who the consumers are who really care about them. So things like mule foot hog, that is some of the most delicious pork I've ever had in my life, really declined and declined because it wasn't differentiated in the market from other kinds of pork. And now the value-added markets that restaurateurs and community-supported agriculture projects and farmers markets are fostering makes a place for these foods again, particularly the things that have a short season, like in Arizona where I am, there's this delicious date, sinfully delicious. It was probably the fruit in the Garden of Eden that Eve asked Adam to eat. This black sphinx date is the best date I've ever tasted, but it's good only for 3 weeks a year.
The perishableness is one of the other issues.
That's right. And so now, with the fame it's getting, it has a marketplace again, and by eating it, we're voting with our pocketbooks and bellies to have these foods back in our food system.
You know, one of the interesting things that happened that I can't believe is that somehow we were so impressionable to marketing that we were convinced that, or someone in the generations before me was convinced that, you know what, I don't need to go to that bakery. Wonder Bread's better or just as good.
Somebody got convinced that it was better to be able to keep a loaf of bread for 2 weeks than it was to have a loaf of fresh bread.
And we just should have disqualified that from being called bread.
Yes, a different food product.
Well, you know, I think it's a very interesting thing that what we're doing that's so interesting and I think wonderful is we're talking about waking people up to their own taste buds and saying just taste it and pay attention and you'll probably make the right choice. Well, We're going to listen to the news, but we'll come back on the other side of the news and talk more about this subject with Dr. Gary Nobin about reclaiming America's food traditions, which is really super important. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with The Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Dr. Gary Nobin is our guest today. His work is to save America's food traditions, and he works at it pretty hard. He's won a MacArthur Fellowship, a Genius Award, and his latest book is Renewing America's Food Traditions, Saving and Savoring the Continent's Most Endangered Foods.
Dr. Nobin, earlier in the show, Francis spoke of the Ramapo tomato. The Ramapo tomato was the tomato that really made Jersey tomatoes famous. And we were talking earlier about the fact that that tomato's not really grown in New Jersey anymore. And what we need to do to start regrowing those tomatoes to get that tomato to come back to New Jersey is eat it more. But it's not the only thing that's like that. Counterintuitively, I think sometimes we don't realize what we can do to bring these foods back. Can you talk a little bit about bringing these foods back and how we need to do it?
Well, it's a multi-stage process, but chefs as trendsetters have played a major role in this. We've had over 500 chefs involved in what we call American traditions picnics, where some of these foods are back in restaurants and catered events for the first time in decades. And so one thing is that chefs and caterers do the improvisation to figure out how to use the textures and colors and flavors and fragrances of these foods in a special way that other people can then pick up on. So, for instance, I raise Navajo Churro sheep, the oldest breed of sheep in North America, and yet you don't cook it like New Zealand mutton. It has it's range-fed. It has a different texture and quality to the meat, and that takes some improvisation and adaptation, which is something that chefs love, home cooks love. And so each of these foods has its own niche. But by telling the stories in a great way, not just talking about the genes in the food or the vitamins or the minerals, by reminding people that these are part of our shared cultural heritage and making them as delicious as possible, I think we can bring the 1,000 foods now at risk in North America back to our tables.
And they offer nuances that, you know, pork that you buy in the supermarket, for instance, just won't offer you, or even lamb.
Well, when we were kids, there were maybe 15, 20 beers available in stores. Look at all the microbrews now. People don't think that beer is just one thing or bread is just one thing anymore. And it's now dawning on us that there are great tastes beyond the 19 apples that are found in most grocery stores or the three kinds of beef or pork, and that there's nuances within nuances, and we're really rediversifying our flavor palette again.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is you talk about the restaurant of chefs, and we operate restaurants, obviously, and we're talking about this Rempo tomato thing. We saw it that the seeds were going to be available. There were seeds available, a decent amount of seeds available from a seed bank. We talked to one of our farmers who grows specifically for us, and then we're going to put it on our menu and send out an email saying, Ramapo tomatoes, you remember them? If you're under 30, you don't, so
right.
Come in to dinner.
And, that's great.
But the idea is that people will then in their home gardens plant Ramapo tomatoes. But the interesting thing, you know, tomatoes can be black. Tomatoes can be watery and delicious or just all meat and delicious. Some are good for putting up and some aren't. But you talk about, I don't know, we'll talk about grass-fed beef, which we have on our menu. We have a steak menu, and then we have corn-fed or corn-finished beef at part of it and grass-fed beef on part of it. Well, if you try to cook a medium well or a medium grass-fed steak the way you cook a corn-fed steak, you're going to get a piece of shoe leather. But if you like your steak medium rare and you're careful and you realize when cooking that, you know, each steak is different, well, you can get, I think, a much more flavorful piece of meat out of the grass-fed steak. But the idea is that there are options. And I think,
certainly something different. I think that's exactly what you're talking about
right
and
now. I think that,
something that's different than the corn
steak. And I think that it does challenge the home cook and the professional chef. But that's what we want, isn't it, to be challenged?
That's right. It's that a good chef is like a good musician. You know, you want to improvise out from a 12-bar blues into some wonderful things, and that's part of the joy of doing having the talents that you have, that you're not treating every piece of meat like a frozen T-bone of Angus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and it's also you know, to just beat your analogy to death. It's like taking, you know, it's like, okay, well, the string quartet is nice, but you can have a whole orchestra, you know, if you introduce different instruments, but you have to be able to play them each a little bit differently. It's not, you know, it's not the same thing.
That's right. And the interesting thing is that now we see chefs playing a lead role in conservation. It's not just Ducks Unlimited and World Wildlife Fund saving pandas. Chefs are guiding people into making food choices that stop depleting the rarest fish in the ocean and offer us new tastes with lesser-known fish. And by rediversifying our diets, we're actually taking the pressure off some things that we just hammered for years, and we're making room in the world for other species and other tastes.
Well, talk to us. You talk about 1,000 endangered food items on the North American dinner possibilities. Talk to us about what some of those items are.
Well, in New Jersey and surrounding states, you had cranberries and blueberries found nowhere else. You had things like the Harrison cider apple and the Meek's prolific quince that were big hits in the 19th century, absolutely delicious foods and brews made out of them, hard cider from Harrison cider apple. And then by the start of the 20th century, these foods could hardly be found, and a friend of mine, Tom Burford, actually rediscovered the Harrison cider apple with some New Jersey scouts helping him. But there were literally dozens and dozens of foods. Actually, your region, that nexus between the northern Appalachians and the coastal plains, has some of the highest densities of heirloom foods of any place in North America. You have this rich seafood tradition. You have, you know, it wasn't called the Garden State for nothing. You
mm-hmm.
had incredible mixes of vegetables and fruits. You know, three centuries for these to develop and adapt to your climate.
You know, it's funny, people say, oh, the Garden State, and they drive down the New Jersey Turnpike and watch The Sopranos, and they're like, oh, yeah, the Garden State, right.
Right. It's hard to drive through Elizabeth on the New Jersey Turnpike and think of us as the Garden State.
But by the same token, you know, Mark and I have for over a decade now been involved with the local farms and the local farmers, and, you know, the food shed around here provides some amazing things. The local white peaches. I know Georgia makes great peaches. I've been through Vidalia, Georgia, and I've been through Georgia peach season on my motorcycle and pulled by the side of the road and had peaches off the trees. And they're delicious. But our white peaches...
But they're different.
...are different and extraordinary.
That's right. That's right. And linking our sense of place to our sense of taste, taking pride in that New Jersey peach, and saying maybe it's the terroir of our soils that makes it different from that of Georgia. We know terroir exists in wines and in maple syrup. I bet it's true with the great vegetables and fruits you have there.
We know it exists in food. Francis and I have experienced it.
Well, you know, it's funny. We talk about the sense of terroir, and that's sort of a scary word just because it's French. But you don't have to like or anything with it. It's just one of the simple French words. But I want to talk about that, which is basically food tasting like, not just good, and a good example of what it is, but tasting like where it comes from. And that's not a myth. And we'll talk more about that with Dr. Gary Nobin in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1145.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work. Until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Dr. Gary Novin, a conservation scientist. His project is Renewing America's Food Traditions. You can find out more about it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We were talking, Dr. Novin, a moment ago about terroir, which basically, I'll translate for the listeners, it's a French word, and the literal translation is land. But it really, when used to describe wine, means more a sense of place, the idea that a Cabernet Sauvignon from this vineyard will taste very different from the Cabernet Sauvignon, exact same grape farmed the exact same way, but grown on a slightly different vineyard. And what you're tasting is the difference in terroir and the difference in the sense of place. And you say that it's not just grapes and wine grapes that have that, but maybe it's because wine is maybe more examined than any other sort of fruit that we see it. But all fruits have, or many fruits have a sense of terroir. Is that your point?
That's right. And terroir goes beyond the soil to really how climate affects the food, particularly microclimates even 10 miles apart shape the ripening times of fruits in different ways, and even the way that maple syrup is processed, not just the soil and rock type that it grows on, influences the flavor. So it's a combination of sort of environmental and cultural elements that give each food something very distinctive. And the old timers knew this. They could say, oh, that watermelon is from this part of New Jersey, or that peach is from the hills over here by the Delaware Water Gap. And they could taste that because they sought those things out.
Well, and, you know, it's funny. Wine grape farmers, is a reason that wine grape farmers sort of ran away from modern agribusiness, which introduces a lot of pesticides and chemicals to sort of sterilize a plot of land, and then introduces chemical fertilizers or salt-based fertilizers to put nutrition into the land, because when you treat your land that way, you sort of sterilize it and make all land the same. You eliminate the differences in microflora or microfauna that are in the soil. And I think the same thing happens with fruit and vegetables. It happens with wine grapes.
And honestly, I don't think it's just the soil. I think it's the air. I think it's everything that affects. It's the water that runs through the property. It's everything that affects the growing of that fruit or vegetable, or frankly, even sometimes animal.
So what are we going to find in Renewing America's Food Traditions? We have recipes in here, I see.
And the recipes are historic ones that give a sense of how these foods were used for decades or centuries, because I didn't want to pretend like I was a chef. I wanted to give you guys a point of departure of saying, oh, they use this bean with this onion. How interesting. What if I do something with those two elements together? Or what if I pit bake this Tennessee fainting goat or whatever? How can I improvise on that historic point of departure?
Well, and you know, the thing about historic recipes is contemporary recipes in modern cookbooks are usually, well, not very good. They're usually wrong, right? And historic recipes are notoriously wrong if you follow them slavishly.
Right.
But the idea of an old recipe is to give you
a jumping off point,
a context.
That's right. That's right. It's where you leap from.
Yeah. Well, and also, you know, there's a general context of how other folks used the food or the food product, but you know, they have, there's some insight there, that you may choose to accept or reject or build upon or have a counterpoint to. But it's really important, you know. I remember, you know, we're sort of intellectually impoverished, even when we're not impoverished, when we don't remember our food traditions. And I remember there was a program, we had someone on who was talking about, oh, this is a year and a half ago, I wish I could remember the exact show, but they talked about how they got some local farms to donate produce to bring to welfare shelters in the inner city, in Camden and in Trenton, and basically give away these vegetables, you know, subsidized by the government, to these people who were in need of food. The problem was they didn't know what to do with them.
Didn't know how to use them.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And I think that we can intellectually find ourselves, if you're not a professional cook, if you're not a professional chef, in the same sort of situation. Like, okay, I have a pawpaw.
Yeah. Right.
Pawpaw is an unusual fruit that's actually kind of difficult to deal with. Wonderful if you use properly. But someone hands you a pawpaw, it's full of seeds. You're like, what the heck am I going to do with this? And the only way we found out how to use pawpaws was to do research and find old recipes that we didn't use, but we used as a jumping-off point.
And it's not just the recipes. I think you made a good point. A pawpaw underripe is terrible. The same thing with a persimmon. But knowing the color change in the skin of the fruit or the pulp and how soft or hard it should be is something that we leave out of recipes now, but people need those now because we've forgotten something that was common knowledge even 30 years ago.
But that takes us all the way back to our earlier point. A pawpaw, when ripe, doesn't travel very well.
Right.
So you better use a pawpaw from close by, or it's going to be terrible.
It's like I had an heirloom apricot tree, and when those apricots started to fall off the tree, you know, the equivalent of vine-ripened tomatoes, I'd just take the day off and sit under the tree with a basket in my lap.
You know, you and we would get along. I'm sure of that.
I don't know. If I ate all those apricots, I might have to take the next day off, too.
I want to talk about one aspect to this, and this is, you know, we talk about the home cook and we talk about the professional chef. We talk about a guy like Mike Baker, who's an attorney by trade, but has these acres that he's preserving from development in East Brunswick, New Jersey, and works with us to supply us with a lot of these foods and works as organically as possible. But you're involved in the native seeds search, right?
I was one of the founders, yes.
And, you know, the home gardener is a really important part of this puzzle. Isn't the home gardener an important part of keeping a lot of these native foods going?
That's right. If home gardeners hadn't taken an interest in these seeds 20 years ago, we'd be left with about a tenth of the diversity that we had. And now community-supported agriculture is stepping up to join the home gardeners. But, boy, I'm grateful to those people.
Yeah, and I have to say, we really have to send a salute out to those, because if it weren't for them keeping those seeds alive by conserving the seeds themselves and trading them amongst themselves, they would be gone.
The home gardener and the small farmer, those are the guys who saved all the seeds.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Well, and Dr. Gary Nabin, your work in saving the seeds in our food traditions is much appreciated.
Great work.
Well, I'm grateful for the work that you and many of your listeners do. Thank you, guys.
Well, it was a pleasure to have you on the show. We'll have to have you back again and harass you sometime in the future. You can find out more about Gary Nabin and his work at GaryNabin.com. We'll, of course, put a link up later today from our website, RestaurantGuysRadio.com, 1450 WCTC. It's 1155.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi, who were in the Star Ledger today, I might add. You want to go check out the Star Ledger? Big picture of our mugs in the studio on the front page of the food section. We were talking about terroir with Dr. Gary Nabin. He's a pretty important guy, and he does a lot of great, great work. And that idea of the sense of terroir, the sense of that, you know, a fruit from someplace tastes different than a fruit maybe down the road. Famous winemaker, a friend of ours named Paul Hobbs, who makes one of the most sought-after winemakers in the world, talks about when, and you know, everyone accepts the idea of terroir in wine, but can you have it in an apple? Well, Paul tells a story about how he got into winemaking and how he became fascinated with it. And Paul's family was poor when he was growing up, large family, poor family, and his dad was a farmer. And they had a farm.
An apple farmer.
And for a while, they had to move into the barn and rent out the house to be able to keep the farm. I mean, they were not a family of means. But he said he used to walk the fields with his dad, and his dad used to be able to take an apple and talk about how the apple from one side of the farm tasted differently than the apple from the other
side.
Even
though they're exactly the same breed.
Now, this is a poor farmer in upstate New York, and I'm sure he'd never used the word terroir in his whole life. but Paul talked about how that affected him, and he could see that, and he developed his palate in that way. So it's not just fancy schmancy wine. It's, you know, when you find a local farm that has a good apple, it's not the same as the red delicious apple in the supermarket. There's no way that it's the same. Even if it's as good a quality as a different farm, the two farms are different. And that's the diversity of food, and that's what makes it worth looking at.
And that's affected Paul even in the way he makes wine today. Paul, whenever he can, uses what we call indigenous yeasts. He lets the yeasts from
the ambient yeast in the
environment. Affect his wine rather than inoculating with one single strain of yeast, because he believes that helps his wine have a singular characteristic that makes it his.
Quick story in the last minute. My uncle Bill Hackett in East Orange used to grow great tomatoes, beautiful tomatoes, huge tomatoes. They were amazing. We loved them. And so we always wanted the Uncle Bill's from his backyard, the terroir, until they came around and told him that there had been a watch factory there 100 years ago, and they used to dump the radioactive radium paint that they would
make. Makes for awesome tomatoes, radioactive paint.
Makes for large tomatoes. But they stopped by to say, yeah, if you live in this neighborhood, don't eat anything you grow in your garden. So that was the last of the radioactive tomatoes.
Basically what they were saying is, if you live in this neighborhood, move.
And they did. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.